Hi everyone, I'm Maggie McGrath, the editor of Forbes Women, and today we are sitting down with Dr. Stella Dantist. She is the president-elect of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, also known as ACOG, and she's going to break down the state of reproductive health in America in 2024. Stella, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We are speaking at the end of a week in which the Florida Supreme Court set in motion a 6-week abortion ban in the state. It won't take effect immediately, but within a few weeks, residents in Florida will have a lot harder of a time accessing abortion procedures. Meanwhile, ballot initiatives in Arizona to allow voters to vote on abortion access seem to be moving forward. There was something in Ohio earlier this week where the attorney general said that the abortion ban on the books in the state appears unconstitutional in the wake of a November 2023 vote by citizens to allow abortions in the state. It's kind of confusing when you look at the map. What is your diagnosis of the state of reproductive health in America right now? What's the 30,000-foot view?
Well, the 30,000-foot view is quite challenging, right? We have a very diverse legislative landscape, and as I sit right now, I'm in Portland, Oregon, where I practice, and in the Northwest, in Portland, Oregon, Washington, we have great protections for full reproductive access, including to abortion care. And as you mentioned, other parts of the country, Florida, Ohio, Arizona. We've had challenges to reproductive access. Bans have gone in place for abortion. My neighboring state of Idaho has had significant challenges with the criminalization of the practice of medicine when you're providing abortion care. So it's challenging right now. It's very confusing for patients. It's creating barriers for patients. Again, abortion is reproductive health care. And so when a patient goes in to see their physician, their clinician for counseling on options on what to do, the menu of options is limited depending on where you live, where your zip code is. And if they want to seek out the full access, they have barriers of having to travel. They have barriers of worry of will they be prosecuted? And clinicians and physicians have the same concerns, right? And confusion. So if I live in a state like Oregon and I want to provide that care, can I be prosecuted for providing that care for somebody who is coming from a state where that is a criminal act? So it's challenging, and we are, continuing to try to fight to be able to provide evidence-based care to all our patients.
Let's stay on Florida for just a minute here because that news happened not too many days ago. What are you telling patients or physicians who are counseling patients in that state who are now kind of in flux in this state of, well, I currently can access the procedure, but in a few weeks I might not be able to? What are the questions that you are answering?
Well, given I don't live in Florida, so our practitioners in Florida, again, lots of confusion, and I know our leaders down there are doing the best they can to educate people. Again, ACOG is a membership organization. We're not one that can give out legal advice. However, we have updated all of our websites in terms of what care can be provided in terms of safe, evidence-based abortion care. Now, in terms of with that ruling, it is going to be counseling patients again on options, and then patients are going to have to figure out the means if they have to travel, if they need to access something that they can't after 6 weeks.
Now, recognizing you're a membership organization, not a legal organization, I am going to ask you about the Supreme Court, but from a care perspective. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments just last week on the FDA's approval of mifepristone. Legal analysts seem to be reading the tea leaves and analyzing the questions from the court in a way that suggests that we might see the court just throw out the case on legal standing. But we're waiting for that verdict from the Supreme Court. What does that mean for you? What does that mean for the physicians within ACOG while we're in this kind of limbo?
Well, right now, we're educating people. Nothing has changed right now, right? So we are able, again, updating our education, making sure people understand when mifepristone and can be used in abortion and miscarriage management. And what we're waiting for the ruling that will happen, from what I'm to understand, is in June. And right now, we are able to prescribe, you know, we don't have an in-person requirement to dispense the medication. We don't have a requirement for in-person visits for, you know, and we can prescribe it for up to 10 weeks. And so if the ruling goes in a way that is not favorable to evidence-based care, then we will be going back to the way we could use mifepristone before 2016, which would again create barriers. But right now, we do not have those barriers, and we are hoping for a favorable ruling.
Just so people understand, what was the way in which you used mifepristone in 2016 and before, and what is the worst case scenario here?
Well, so just the opposite of what I said. So then we would not be able to use telehealth to provide this care. We would have to require, we wouldn't be able to dispense like through the mail, you know, we would have to have somebody come in to get the medication in person. We would have to see a patient in person to do the care for abortion care, miscarriage management, where we are using mifepristone, and we would not be able to use it for care of a termination up to 10 weeks of pregnancy. So what this would create is barriers again for our patients. We have patients who have to travel long distances to access this care. And if you are able to provide care via telehealth, you know, it's easy for us to talk today because we can do this over Zoom. And that's the care we want for our patients when it's safe and effective. And in this case, it is. And I speak to that also, not just for patients who live in rural areas or who have transportation challenges because of large distances, or maybe they live in a zip code or a state where they don't have access to safe abortion care or mifepristone for miscarriage management. They can access care far away and get counseling over Zoom, over a telehealth, a virtual opportunity, and then have medications mailed to them. Now we're asking people to come in, and that affects people also in a city. I mean, there are people with barriers to transportation, financial challenges, they work, they have children that would need to have childcare. If they were to come in, take several buses to come in for that, and it's not necessary. And then again, like I said, we would not be able to use it for up to 10 weeks.
When we talk about barriers to care, there's even just in the city case that you referenced, right? If someone is mobility challenged and or a shift worker, think about the lost wages, the money that you would spend to have someone watch your family if you're caregiving, I'll say of any age, right? It's a tremendous burden that we're looking at. Shifting to another reproductive health service that has been in the news over the past few months, IVF. Again, this is state specific. The Alabama Supreme Court released a ruling that indicated that frozen embryos have basically personhood rights, and that's throwing IVF in the state of Alabama into chaos. What are you hearing in Oregon? What questions are you getting from physicians and or patients around the country right now? Because I feel like I've talked to a lot of women who are now not sure if it's a good idea to freeze embryos in any state.
Yeah, I think it's, again, creating a lot of fear, because what we see, and we've seen that over the past couple of years, what we see in one state may come to your state or a neighboring state. And so people are really worried about the future of IVF and reproductive, you know, infertility. It's really challenging because these women in Alabama, you know, it comes easy for some people, right? They get pregnant, they can have a family. These people have invested significant time, emotion, financial resources into these embryos, and now to think that one, they don't have access, and there's a timeline, right, for this. And so as access to their embryos, access to this care is shutting down or on hold with the fear of what is to come, their lives are on hold. And like I said, there is a timeline. It's not an infinite amount of time that your success rate for IVF just goes on. And so it's very challenging. And I think for women watching this play out in Alabama, it's a scary thought, and people don't really know what the best path is.
Now, you've talked a lot about the education that ACOG is doing. What is the, and it, there's so many aspects to this. We've already talked about abortion, miscarriage, and IVF. So what are the one or two things that you find yourself repeating that people don't seem to understand? And I say people broadly as the public, like, what is the biggest point of clarification you find yourself making these days?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that question, because I think these topics that we're talking about are personal, are emotional. And I think what I spend time clarifying is that this is evidence-based medicine, where we're talking about IVF, when we're talking about abortion, or we're talking about miscarriage management. Physicians and clinicians go through a lot of training to understand the evidence and how to provide evidence-based quality healthcare to our patients. And ultimately, it's our patients' decisions. So we can counsel them, we can give them the data, and then they make a decision as to how best they see their care. And it's that legislative interference piece that I think when you get caught up in the specific topic, that sometimes you miss. And whether you are a physician, whether you are an attorney, whether you are an accountant, you are all the experts in what you do. And that expertise, nobody should have barriers to getting that expertise. And it's scary, right? The misinformation that's out there. It's easy to get information in this day and age, and people can click on anything. And so they'll get misinformation, and where the sanctity of that expertise is between a physician, a clinician, and a patient. And so all of this legislative interference puts us at risk for all of that going away, no matter what profession, no matter what trade you have.
Did you ever imagine when you started your training to be a physician that there would be this level of legislative interference into your work?
No, I don't. I went into medicine it's a service, right? It's a calling and a service. And I went into it to help patients. I went in it to, there's a relationship there, and a very special relationship between a physician and a patient. And we went into it to give safe care, right? Do no harm. And I think that's the other piece of it. The safety of mifepristone, I mean, people are losing that in these conversations. So again, I really encourage people to look at the data and to try to look at a little bit of a higher view as to what is going on. And as we make these decisions, what's at risk to come next?
I know ACOG signed an amicus brief in the mifepristone case, indicating how safe and effective it is compared to other medications. I often hear compared to Tylenol when people are talking about the safety and efficacy. What is your message to legislators or politicians or folks watching this who've gotten caught up in the politics of it and are starting to doubt the medical community? And I ask this question with a bias. I have doctors in my family. I've seen how hard they work. And when I hear people without medical degrees questioning their expertise, I get a little defensive on their behalf. But what's your message to those who think they know something without having gone through the medical training that you and other physicians have?
Well, in the mifepristone case, mifepristone is extremely safe. I mean, we have had tons of medical reviews, clinical trials, and millions of patients that have used it over two decades. We know it's safe, and we know it provides for miscarriage management and for abortion care, safe care. It's more effective. And the risks of excessive bleeding or significant infection or hospitalization is less than 0.32%. It's safer than the use of Viagra. It's a safe medication. And for the people thinking it's causing people to come in bleeding more or access, more hospitalizations, a miscarriage that is not managed has the same risk of significant bleeding, incomplete miscarriage, someone with excessive blood loss accessing the medical system. And this actually manages all of that effectively and allows people to get back to their life quicker because there's a longer emotional burden for that patient. The physical, you know, we can help take care of and help expedite, and to ask people to not have access to this medication and to have more challenging physical time. You know, I ask them to consider that. Again, realize that it's safe and effective, and has had 2 decades of data to support that.
You talk about entering the medical profession to serve, to do no harm. As I think about the nation's medical students, and as I've seen reports about where doctors, or at least medical students in training, are considering spending their careers, there have been reports ever since the Dobbs decision overturned Roe v. Wade that there's less interest in OBGYN, or less interest in certain states that have enacted laws against abortion access. What are you seeing at ACOG in terms of how our nation's doctors and doctors in training are thinking about their careers and choosing which path to go down?
Well, it's interesting because I think, again, people who are drawn to medicine, it's a calling, and it's a calling to advocate for patients and service. So this whole movement in the last couple of years with the Dobbs decision has provided a calling for many people to want to help in this movement and to provide care. However, it's challenging because in some of our states, they don't have access, again, to full scope reproductive health care. And so one is, how do we help protect that training? How do we provide means for people who are in a state that don't have access to abortion training? Abortion training is miscarriage, also management training. And how do we support sending them to a state that can provide that training? But then also what we're seeing is people moving out of certain parts. We're seeing these maternity care deserts. Some of that is because of closures of hospitals and labor and delivery units because they cannot support having those services due to inadequate reimbursement and other issues. So they're closing. However, we're also seeing people leave these states where they cannot give full scope reproductive health care access because of fear of criminalization. And then also to think, you know, our jobs, while very rewarding, are challenging. They're long hours. They're a lot of work. They can be physically exhausting. And to have to, whether you're in Idaho and you see a patient with either an ectopic or a miscarriage and they're bleeding, and to have your hands tied to not be able to care for a patient until it is life-threatening, and to have to watch and get to that point where you're teetering on that, to have to, one, watch your patient suffer through that, to one, be worrying about when am I okay? When am I not going to be at risk for criminalization? I have a family to take care of. I can't be in jail. I can't go through that. I can't put my family through that. That stress day in, day out wears on people, and then they're not going to want to practice in those places. So that is what we need to fix. If we're going to fix healthcare for everybody and break down the barriers and have equitable care for everybody, we need to make sure that it is safe and viable to practice everywhere around this country.
I hear the term maternity care desert, and it just is so scary because even before Dobbs came down, motherhood mortality in the United States was lagging our peers in other developed nations. How are you balancing your attention on, you know, there's critical political issues kind of going on that, as we've discussed, affect state by state rules. It makes the map incredibly complicated in standards of care. But then there's that ongoing issue that pre-existed Dobbs of making sure that people can safely deliver children in the United States.
Yeah. I spoke to the birth center closures, right? And ACOG, you know, ACOG does a lot of work in education. It does a lot of work in advocacy. And part of the work it does in advocacy is also looking at payment, fair, equitable, and valued payment for obstetrical and gynecological services. And, you know, we have had cuts to the continued cuts to Medicare, the poor reimbursement for Medicaid, And when you think about more than 50% of births are Medicaid, we want to make sure that we are providing that care. And if I'm a physician living in a place, I've decided to raise my family there and I want to provide care to the community, I can't control if a hospital cannot stay open because, you know, the number of births in a rural area is not going to be the same as the number of births in Portland, Oregon, or in LA. So whereas a hospital in one of these more populated areas can stay open because even though reimbursement's low, they have enough volume to keep it open, you know, a rural area just simply cannot. So we need to solve that issue, again, to make it equitable so that we can keep birth centers open in these smaller areas with smaller number of births. Because whether it's one birth, whether it's 10 births, 15 births, all those women need access. And if you have a woman who has to travel 3 hours for a 15-minute OB appointment, which is very important, we have to take their weight, we have to, you know, we have to listen to the baby. There are many things that we have to do. They're not going to seek that care. So we need to look at reimbursements. We also need to support more opportunities for remote monitoring. So, for example, even in my practice right now, people that live in a city, we give them a blood pressure cuff and they can monitor their blood pressure at home and input those and I can see them. But we have to give that to them. We have to support that. People can't afford a blood pressure cuff. So what are the things that we can do to give people opportunities for remote monitoring, make sure they have the internet Wi-Fi to support that. So we have a lot of work to do in this country to, again, break down those barriers to get people to access care in ways that they can.
We've covered a lot of ground, but you also have a very big job. Is there anything that we haven't discussed today, but is something that you're thinking about and working on a day-to-day basis right now?
Well, you know, yeah, I have a big job, but luckily ACOG is run by amazing people. As I go into this next year, as we've been coming out of a pandemic, what I really want to reemphasize and focus on is how we do this all together. You know, we've been siloed during the pandemic and just bringing that community back. And if we remember during the pandemic, we had one thing we had to come together to work on, you know, and so there was this common thread that brought us together. And now as we come out of it, you know, as we continue to see backlogs, you know, just coming out of a pandemic, we have legislative interference coming at us. We still need to band together. We can't splinter apart as we look at these challenges ahead and to really remember we're stronger together than working in silos. So I just really, you know, I can't thank ACOG enough for the community they have provided me as I've been growing in my leadership journey. I can't thank my partners here enough for all the support they've given me as well along my leadership journey. You don't do it alone.
Stella Dantas, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.